The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our award-winning author events series, recorded live at the Parkway Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, our unique and inspiring collections, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org.
Welcome to the Free Library and to the first Natalie Cohn Memorial Lecture. Let me introduce myself. I'm Herb Cohn. I had the honor and privilege of being married to Natalie for over 59 years until she unfortunately passed away last year. For years, Natalie and I would look forward to coming to this lecture series on a regular basis. It would usually start with, and I quote, "Dear, we have the library tonight." Then we would have dinner, usually with friends at a nearby restaurant like the Rose Tattoo, and follow that with a stimulating evening listening to a vast array of wonderful authors discussing their recent creations here at the library. As we dedicate this lectureship to the memory of Natalie, beloved wife, mother, grandmother, and friend, his origin can best be expressed in her own words, which she wrote when we joined the Pepper Society, and I quote, "I am passionate about the Free Library because it's been an integral part of my life since childhood, and it still holds the same sense of joy and wonderment each time we enter. Thank you for keeping this institution in good health for the foreseeable future," end quote. We hope that you will derive the same sense of joy and wonderment as you utilize the Free Library to expand your knowledge and enjoyment of the human experience through all the resources that this great institution has to offer. We're thrilled to offer this lectureship as just one part of that wondrous library experience. As you saw in the wonderful short video before tonight's program, the Free Library carries out critical work each and every day to advance literacy, guide learning, and inspire curiosity in the greater Philadelphia region. If you value the library as much as I do, please consider making a gift of support in Natalie's name through the foundation. The foundation makes possible many of the library's incredible programs, like tonight's event. Visit library.org/support to make your gift. It's now my pleasure to introduce tonight's author, E.L. Doctorow, one of Natalie's favorite authors. According to Time magazine, E.L. Doctorow concocts, and I quote, "a ferocious reimagining of the past, then returns it to us as something powerful and strange in novels such as The Book of Daniel, Ragtime, World's Fair, and Homer and Langley." He's received numerous awards and honors, including the 2012 Penn Sol Bello Award for Achievement in American Fiction, the National Book Award, 2 National Book Critic Circle Awards, 2 Penn Faulkner Awards, the National Humanities Medal, and the 2013 Medal for Distinguished Contribution to American Letters. As Joyce Carol Oates writes in The New Yorker, Doctorow is, and again I quote, "a writer of dazzling gifts and boundless imaginative energy," end quote. His new novel is Andrew's Brain, a radical and lyrical trip through the mind that raises probing questions about what we know about our memories and each other. He'll be interviewed tonight by Jim Holt, whom you'll meet, the best-selling author of, quote, "Why Does the World Exist? An Existential Detective Story." Ladies and gentlemen, please join me in welcoming E.L. Doctorow to the Free Library.
How were the introductions? Were they good? I'm just by way of introduction, I'm going to say how fortunate we all are to be in the presence of one of the, you know, the great world literary figures of the last half century. And not only that, I want to quote something I came across from John Leonard, who was a great literary critic and was actually editor of the Times Book Review for a while, wasn't he?
I'm not sure.
Anyway, he's no longer with us, but he had a very voluble and diffuse style of writing, and he described E.L. Doctorow, this was many, many years ago in the New York Review of Books, as a mild-mannered Clark Kent kind of guy, more likely to be registering a voter or building a harpsichord than rousing a rabble or leading a charge. But, he said, E.L. Doctorow, beneath this placid exterior, there's a cauldron of fury. He's a radical historian, and he went on to say, a cultural anthropologist, a troubadour, a private eye, a magus, a stormbird, a Sherlock, an ancient mariner, Citizen Doctorow, Prophet Edgar. So which one of those labels would you like to renounce?
No, I agree with all those comments.
Oh, not ancient mariner. You're fixing me with that glittering eye, and you're going to tell me a long story. anyway. So over the last 3 days, I had the great pleasure of reading Andrew's Brain, and a novel I commend to you all. It's a weird novel. I'm going to shut up in just a minute, I promise. But the novel was, first of all, it's very slight. It's 200 pages. But strangely potent. It's mysterious and ambiguous, but very lucid at the same time. In fact, it's pellucid. I love using the word pellucid once a year. I mean, it's actually clear as gin, but mysterious, and it's morally earnest, but it's full of irony. So. I'm going to shut up now and just ask you to say, we don't want to give away, I mean, the plot, it's a very unreliable narrator, so it's in the side of the head of a guy who's, you know, a little crazy, a little bumptious, a little self-important, and it goes in directions that are utterly unexpected, and the ending is very powerful. So... tell me, I mean, for you, writing is an adventure. When you start a novel, you're not sure where it's going to go, and if things are going well, it picks up speed, and you said that the last part of it is almost like skiing downhill as you see the conclusion coming. But on the other hand, you've said writing, is a very difficult task. You do 6 to 8 drafts of each novel. And so how, this novel, this is a, you know, was this difficult, or was this just an ebullience of an intellectual mood? Is that a question?
I think it was a question. Would anyone like to answer it? No, you have to realize whenever a writer of fiction talks about what he's done and how he's done it, he's continuing to write fiction. However, I will say that that this particular book, as several others, began with a very evocative scene that came to me, and I didn't quite know why, but it was and it's right there on the first page. A man is standing in the snow in front of a door of a house, and he's holding an infant, a swaddled infant, in his arms, and it's snowing. And he's wearing a Yankees baseball cap, and the snow is alighting on the brim of his cap. And I didn't know what he was doing there. I knew he was waiting to be admitted into the house and for the door to open, and that it was a matter of some urgency. And that's the way that book began. It might have also had its roots in a something I'd heard many, many years ago. I was working for a fellow in the story department of a movie company. He was my boss, and he told me one day, and he was a gentle, kind man, that he had been responsible for the death of his infant by feeding the wrong medicine into the child's mouth. And somewhere along the line, I realized that picture I had of the fellow standing in front of the door was related to that story that had been told to me many, many years ago. So that's the way it begins very often. With Billy Bathgate, for instance, I had this vision of men in black ties standing on the deck of a tugboat, a workboat, and it was such a disparate kind of association of images that I wondered why they were there, and that's the way that book began. So it's very often that this is the way things do begin, but sometimes you have these feelings, these evocative states, but they don't lead to books. They lose their energy somehow 5 or 10 pages later. But Andrew's brain began that way, yeah.
Yeah, so Andrew, Andrew of the title is seems to be a cognitive scientist who's having who's telling a story to an interlocutor who he refers to as Doc, who seems to be an analyst, he's recounting his two marriages, the death of a child under circumstances along the lines just described. You're almost inside of his brain. It's a weirdly solipsistic novel. We're used to, many of your novels have been, historical panoramas crowded with characters, actual historical characters interacting with fictional characters. And this one is, initially it seems it's on a much more intimate scale, although it certainly does broaden. Actually, it's set in the years between the turn of the millennium and a few years before the present. So, of course, it includes the events of 9/11, and these do figure in the plot in rather seamlessly. And it's one of the more successful attempts I've come across to incorporate the 9/11 into a novelistic structure.
But just giving something away to these people.
Oh, I'm sorry. I won't do any. Let me ask you about.
But
I've already committed a gaffe.
I will. No, it's all right. I object to the term historical novelist, and I admit I recognize it's often done in a complimentary way. But if you think about it, all novels take place in the past, some in the distant past, some in the recent past. And depending on the focus of the novel, it can be wide enough to include public figures and major events like wars. Or if the focus is narrower, it would be a personalist kind of book with about one's family and as characters which nobody knows. So it's wrong to think that a particular novel is an historical novel when they all are. There's no ontological difference whether the focus is wide or the focus is narrow. And the other thing is that what is the other thing? There's another thing, but I like to talk about this. The thing about Andrew's brain is that I decided I would follow Ezra Pound's injunction. He said, make it new. Ezra Pound was a poet. He was talking to other poets, but I responded to that. After a while, if you do this kind of work, you really want to revolt. You don't want to do formulaic fiction anymore. And that mood began to strike me about 10 or 11 years ago when I wrote City of God, which is a great collage of a book, and where the tension depends on discontinuity rather than a linear narrative. Andrew's brain is similarly obsessed that it does break rules, and it satisfies my feeling whenever I think I'm doing something good. It turns out I am transgressing. But fiction is a very conservative art. It's the most conservative of the arts. If you think about what has happened in music in the past 150 years, when the great romantics hit Mahler and then Stravinsky came along, and into the 20th century, someone like Shostakovich. There's enormous change in the nature of music, and then art, of course, beginning with, I guess, the Impressionists, and then the Cubists, Picasso and Braque, and then coming up into abstract expressionism and conceptual art. Enormous changes. Whereas fiction has stuck to its realistic formulas of imitating a real world and making a clear distinction between what was real and what was in someone's mind. So now there have been writers, of course, who have tried to break out, Joyce being a perfect example. When he was a beautiful writer in Dubliners and Portrait of the Artist as a young man, but then there came Ulysses and then Finnegan's Wake, and Virginia Woolf decided that she couldn't write, didn't want to write a novel that had a plot anymore. So she went that way, and this so-called Stream of Consciousness and Mrs. Dalloway, which is a beautiful book. But in Joyce's case, that was a dead end. And I think the postmodern impulse has been rather timid, actually. So what are you going to do after you try to break out? In this case, in Andrew's brain, it's basically could be considered a series of images that are iterated and reiterated over and over again. His obsession with Mark Twain, his picture in his mind of a child who is drawing with a colored pencil on her pad, and who's, when she sees an adult watching her, she scribbles over the drawing she's just tried to do. And there are several events or images like this that get circulated through the book as it progresses. And I'm pleased to say that there's no, you called him an unreliable narrator. This is true. There is no distinction made between what is real and what is imagined. You cannot tell as you listen to Andrew talk. The way the book is set up, someone is doing most of the talking and someone is doing most of the listening. It's Andrew who's doing most of the talking, and someone he calls Doc is doing the listening. And the nature of this relationship changes. And I'm very pleased to have heard from early readers that different interpretations of the book, of what it was, how it was constituted. One person said to me that the person who's listening is the ventriloquist and Andrew's the dummy. I really liked that. I thought that was neat. And then at one point, Andrew says, tell me, Doc, am I a computer? And Doc says, of course not. You're a human being. And Andrew says, well, you would say that, wouldn't you? So another reader came to me and said, Andrew's a computer, isn't he? So I accept any interpretation as long as it doesn't claim to be exclusive.
Yeah, it lends itself to interpretive, you know, co-labor of the reader. And what I love about it, I mean, something like this could be done, it could be unpleasant and turgid. You've made it, the prose itself is so lucid and the images are so vibrant that you know, one's attention never wanders, and the mysteriousness and the ambiguity of it are positively pleasurable. Okay, I'm going to stop building up your ego. I'm sorry. One of the images I found terrifying in it, by the way, for personal reasons, the young Andrew is remembering walking his pet dachshund in Washington Square in Greenwich Village in New York, where he used to live off Washington Square, right? And there are one or two hawks that now live in Washington Square. And I walk my dachshund in Washington Square. The dog's actually named Archie after the Washington Square Arch. And I watch these hawks, and I'm a little uncomfortable. But in the novel, may I give this away? yeah, he's still good. Anyway, let me just say that there's a terrifying image that may be less terrifying for you than it was for me. And I just hope that it doesn't correspond too closely to reality. So there are big themes in this novel besides, it's a cognitive scientist who is speaking to his analyst, we think. And he's obsessed with, his specialty is the brain and how the brain gives rise to the mind. The analyst presumably is, comes at the mind from a different direction. His beginning notion is that of consciousness and its relation to the unconscious and so forth. And so they're just lurking beneath the surface and coming to the surface occasionally in the novel are ideas about consciousness, how this brain, this 3-pound lump of gray matter in our heads, and somehow gives rise to this incredible technicolor world of consciousness, and not only to that, but a consciousness of the self. We feel that we have an enduring self that comes into existence when we're born, and it's the same self that will age and ultimately die. And the notion of free will. So all of these philosophical concerns are sort of, are at play in the book. And nothing comes to a very decisive resolution. So obviously these sorts of questions, these very deep questions, have been preying on your mind. Question mark.
I wonder if using the word philosophy will discourage people from buying the book.
Oh, no. I hope not. You were...
No.
What's your philosophy? Yes.
I will answer your question. Yeah. It's true that having made Andrew a cognitive scientist and have given him a sad life, because he is what the publishers called an inadvertent agent of disaster with his little puppy in Washington Square who's picked off by a hawk, and then he's...
It's much gruesomer than that.
Sometimes as a child, he's sledding down a street and causes a car to crash and the driver to get killed. And he has this kind of history in all good faith of being an agent of disaster. But he is also a cognitive scientist and a troubled fellow. And he loses his child and his first wife divorces him. He delivers the child of his second wife, who has died, a younger wife, to this first wife, and then goes off to the west to a small college in the foot of the Wasatch Mountains. And there he will teach brain science. But he will also fall in love with the second wife-to-be. So the book sort of turns around in time. But the thing, as he's talking and teaching about the brain, he suddenly stops and he says, "How can I think about my brain if it's my brain doing the thinking? How can I think about my brain if it's my brain doing the thinking? I can't trust anyone these days, least of all myself." And that is, and he walks out of the room. And the only student who follows him is Bryony, who will become his wife. And this kind of conundrum, this kind of treatment of where we stand now in terms of these brain versus mind is very much a part of the book. Right now, people used to have souls, and then everyone was very comfortable having a soul, and that was Descartes' idea. As you all know, that there was a body and there was a soul, and there was no connection between them. of what science did was they said, no, the materialists said, it's all the brain. It's the brain. There's no soul is fiction. But the problem with that is that nobody knows, as of now, how the brain becomes the mind, how that 3-pound knitting ball, which is what Andrew calls it, crackling with electricity, can account for our feelings, our subjective lives of being in love, having longing, having memories, all the states of mind we're in. How do you get that from the brain? And nobody knows that yet. So that's the great struggle now, is between philosophers of mind and neuroscientists, cognitive science. The shocking thing is that if they ever do find this out, and there are people working on this brain mapping and building, emulating the brain with computer networks in Switzerland, thinking that after all the brain is finite, so they're going to work it out someday. But if they ever figure out how the brain becomes the mind, I have two minds or brains about that. One is what a great achievement it might be. And the other is, if that happens, then, and we know how that happens, we'll be able to design computers that have consciousness. If that happens, we're finished. All the old stories that we've depended on, the Bible, all the things we've inherited from the Bronze Age about what it means to be human, will be gone. It'd be as much of a disaster as an asteroid hitting the planet. So on that cheerful note, I thought we'd continue the discussion.
How will we know when a computer is conscious? If it passes the Turing test, if it could fool you into thinking that you were communicating with a human? I mean, this is a great philosophical conundrum. If you can create a perfect simulation of, well, here's a good example. Suppose we do have a computational understanding of how the brain gives rise to the mind. We could use that, if part of your brain went bad, we could remove that part of the brain and add a silicon chip that would perform the equivalent functioning of the part of the brain that's removed. So now you've got mostly a biological brain, but a little bit of a silicon chip that's as a prosthesis. And then another bit of your brain goes bad, and so that's replaced by a silicon chip. But eventually, your entire biological brain is replaced by, in effect, a computer. And so behaviorally, you're just the same. You respond to, you like the same things, and you have the same beliefs, and you carry on the same conversation, and so forth. But how do we know that there's, you know, that sort of inner light, the idea that it's like something to be that thing? How do we know that that exists in the form of silicon chips, the same thing that exists, you know, our biological brain we know gives rise to? We don't know how. So, you know, sometimes philosophers talk about a zombie world where everyone behaves exactly like they do in the real world, have the same sorts of arguments. They even argue about what consciousness is. But everyone, there's no sort of inner light on in that world. And whether this is a genuine possibility or not, no one is quite sure. But I mean, these are the sorts of questions that are obliquely and directly raised by the book. And I just asked you a question, and then I sort of gave a bad answer myself. That's not a good strategy.
I was actually wondering what the question was.
No, the question is, when we replicate human cognition in a computer, how do we know that the computer has feelings? It acts like it has feelings. How do we know that the computer feels pain?
As you well know, there's a philosopher out in California, John Searle, who has done a thought experiment to show that a computer can appear to be conscious and to know what it's doing and to accomplish whatever it's supposed to accomplish without having any understanding or meaning in its mind or in its chips about what it's doing. And so far, I happen to agree with Professor Searle, but things are changing, and in another 50 or 100 years, that thought experiment might not hold. But maybe we're... but I find myself with an impulse to say that, believe it or not, this is also a love story. You've heard of love stories before. That for all its intricate kind of transgressive manipulations of the reader's mind, Andrew does fall in love with this student, Bryony, and they go walking up the mountain, and pretty soon it's not a relationship between teacher and student anymore. But he says Bryony is the kind of person who would make a point of talking to a leper, and thus figuring himself as someone equivalent. And finally, because she's quite taken, she's never seen a professor who is so vulnerable and exhibits so much of his own feelings to a class. And so she's quite attracted to him, and he says to her at one point, "I think I'm going to depress you into marrying me." And they do get together and go see her parents and then go east to New York City. So apart from all his worries and concerns, he does find a kind of redemption and experiencing this unusual state of mind called happiness, which he doesn't quite understand, but he realizes that she's making him happy. I really enjoyed writing that part. I was worried about him, and that there was this kind of redemption possible.
I just got the signal. We have one more question from me, and then we're going to open up to you. I'm can't help asking you about politics. You've been described as our preeminent lefty among novelists. That was by John Leonard. I would put it in a more formal way. But you've shown great political commitment and a serious political conscience. You've been very unhappy by things that have happened over the last few decades. How do you feel about the present conjuncture, as they say in France? Are you cautiously optimistic? Are you what are you morally passionate about that might not be obvious to us?
Well, I think you're complimenting me.
Indeed, I am.
But the fact of the matter is that someone once told me, if anyone gives you a forum, take it. And whatever political things I've written, I've done so reluctantly, because you're trapped into political diction. Well, I'll give you an example. How are you going to do anything with a phrase like campaign finance reform? You're dead in the water if you use words like that. So there's an enormous problem when you come out of your fictive mode and start to write as a citizen or as a reporter or something, that it's painful and you want to get it done as quickly as you can and forget about it. So I have to admit that's the case. What else could I say about that, except that I did write a piece when George Bush was running against John Kerry. There was a little group of people out in Long Island where I live, and they were having a fundraiser for John Kerry, and I wrote a piece saying George Bush didn't understand what death was. And to my astonishment, it was published in the local paper and it went viral on the internet. And my first thought was, why didn't I ask to get paid for that piece? I don't know if that's the spirit of a true patriot. W.H. Auden, the poet, once said that a writer's politics are more of a danger to him than his cupidity. And I agree with that. You cannot imprint your political ideas or beliefs onto a work as if it's a cookie cutter. You can't do that. You're dead. You're not honoring the integrity of the occasion of writing fiction. And what you just trust whatever ideas you have for the book to scan them and choose among them, but always for the sake of the book, never for the sake of anything outside the book. And the third thing I will say is that I'm a registered Democrat, and nothing more than a liberal. Just one of those sloppy liberals that everyone hates. I began to be disillusioned with the first time I was allowed to vote. I voted for Adlai Stevenson, and I thought he spoke so much better than Dwight Eisenhower. He was a shoo-in. And then I learned the lesson that any president who speaks too well is going to lose.
Okay. About that, by the way, Adlai Stevenson. I have to mention the joke that the girls at Radcliffe made back in that era. They said, "I like Ike, but I'd lay Stevenson." Remember, you've heard that joke. Sorry, that has to get said once every 10 years. I just said it. Okay. So, questions, raise your hand and I'll call on you in order.
In your efforts to explore ways of modernizing the novel, you mentioned stream of consciousness, you mentioned getting away from a linear plot development. What are some other avenues that you could see or which you are yourself working with? And will the medium itself, that is to say, the electronic book, offer other ways of modernizing the novel?
Well, e-books. I hate e-books. It's very simple. The book is an incredible bit of technology, and the fact that it was invented a long time ago makes it even more remarkable. If a book is produced, it requires no more energy after it's produced, and you take reasonably good care of it, it lasts forever. And it's a tactile thing, and you feel it. And when you're in a book, it's as if your mind, the reading of the book completes the book, and your mind goes through the sentences as through electric circuit. And I don't think you get that from Kindles. And I like to read with the light behind me, not coming up from the thing. So that's the first thing. In terms of how the novel should progress, I don't know. Any serious writer is in this situation of trying to make it new, and what would work for one book might not work for another. In other words, there's no overall means of accommodating this instinct that we will all have eventually if we do our work for enough and for many years. There's no one system or answer to something like this, but the answers are produced individually from whatever book happens to emerge from the struggle. That you do, as Jim Holt said, you do write to find out what you're writing. And the writing generates the writing, and pretty soon the book begins to tell you what you need to do. It begins to dictate to you. And the further on you go, the fewer things you can do. It gets narrower and narrower, and it is toward the end like sliding down a hill on a pair of skis. So the point is that I was trying to make that in my personal experience, the idea of doing formulative, traditional realistic fiction no longer appeals to me. Other people are quite content to work that way and to accept all the tropes and the conventions that have been in existence for a long, long time. But there's no one answer. There's no one answer.
On that note, I was just curious if you've seen the movie Her, and if you have, what were your reactions to it?
I have not seen the movie Her.
Four of your novels have been made into films.
Yes.
Is it conceivable? I know you have a very a complicated, somewhat vexed relationship with the world of film movie making, but maybe we shouldn't go into that. Let's. I'm cheating you of your opportunity to ask questions. You, sir.
Good evening, sir. If I heard you correctly, you mentioned that you were not happy about being called the historical writer because you believe that all fiction writer is historical. From that point of view, what do you think of Shakespeare? Because, like, for example, if I knew that Shakespeare was working for the King's Company and actually, like, somebody told him, somebody put the outline for him and told him, we need a novel that is being called Henry the Eighth. If I knew that, I would have read Henry the Eighth differently. Is my question clear?
But I suppose it's a great honor in this discussion to hear my name in the same room as William Shakespeare's. But he did everything. He stole a lot of his stuff. You know that, didn't you? He picked up plots from other playwrights and from the Holinshed Chronicles. Do you know that one of his great plays, the one that's probably played more than any other, is Richard III. You remember Richard III kills the children in the tower and takes over the throne and then is defeated in the Battle of Bosworth by the... he's a Plantagenet, isn't he, or something. And someone organized a society in England called the King Richard III Society, because they decided that Shakespeare had unfairly portrayed Richard III, that he was not the deformed soul who went around killing children, and that he was really a good, kind king. So the King Richard III Society is over here, and Richard III, the play of Shakespeare, is over there, and the question is, well, which Richard III would you rather have? And the good king and these people claim that existed, or this unfair portrayal of Richard III, a very, very useful play in that it shows the disease of the preemptive urge to take over, that your life is more significant and important than any other. There's an interesting thing in Andrew's brain where the cruel king is Boris Godunov, the opera fellow, who begs, who does also kill children, and then has a sort of post-traumatic stress disorder, and is afraid that he's done wrong, and he's so upset that he dies. But before he dies, there's a holy fool around him, one of those typical Russian holy fools, whom he begs forgiveness, and the holy fool represents all of Russia, and he does not forgive Boris and walks away. And fortunately, I made that connection to Andrew, who, when he's standing on his hands in the White House, claims that he is the holy fool. I'm not sure I answered your question.
We have time just for one more, and let's see. You there? Yeah. I'm sorry. You had a guy working for you, pointing to you, and it seemed like a put-up job. So I probably had a great question, though.
So Andrew in the novel is a cognitive scientist, and he shows some characteristics, or the novel reflects certain characteristics having to do with the fallibility of memory and self-deception. And I'm wondering, I happen to know that those themes describe two of the biggest sort of themes in cognitive science itself in the past 10 or 20 years. I'm wondering if you were influenced by developments in that field itself in writing the novel.
I think you're asking me how much research I've done. Just enough.
Very nice. I have one final question to ask. That's can't be that. May I ask one last question? This is a really quick one. To you, is there life after death?
You want me to answer that?
Yeah.
Well, I've noticed that fellow over there is raising his hand.
What made you want to become a writer, and what type of authors inspired you?
I was fortunate enough as a boy that my parents were objecting to television, and they didn't have one in the house for the longest time. And all we did was read. We read. Everyone in the family was a reader. I was a reader. And we had music. We had records, and my mother's a pianist. And I would go to the public library and get an armload of books and take them home and read them in the week and take them back. And the writers I read were people. I read Mark Twain, of course, and I read Charles Dickens, and I read Jack London, Call of the Wild, and White Fang, and I read the Captain Horatio Hornblower sea stories, and it went on and on and on. And I didn't care what I read, and I everything from comic books on, I just was voracious. And eventually, as I was reading, I began to ask two questions. The first question is what everyone asks is, what's going to happen next? But there was another question in my mind, which was, how is this done? How is this, these little printed things on a page produce in me such extraordinary excitement and wonder? And I would like to do that. So I decided at the age of 9 that I was a writer. And I didn't really feel it was necessary to write anything for several years after that. I was satisfied to read. And then finally, I found out that I was named, my first name is Edgar, that I was named after Edgar Allan Poe. And I knew he was important because he was in the game called Authors, which is a deck of cards with famous authors. So the first things I wrote were took place in dungeons and cellars and places like that, because that was Edgar Allan Poe type of stuff. And I accepted the fact that my father liked Poe. Actually, he liked a lot of bad writers, but Poe Poe is our greatest bad writer. And it never occurred to me to question this name. Until a few years ago, my late mother, I was talking to her, and suddenly I asked the question that I should have asked long before. I said, Did you and Dad realize you named me after an alcoholic, drug-addicted, delusional paranoid with strong necrophiliac tendencies?
Okay, I'll always like to wrap up on a note of necrophilia. So that was really delightful. Thank you so much.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Free Library of Great Conversations. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information on the series is available at freelibrary.org/authorevents.